lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Nicole Simpson with us. She represents the survivors, the individuals who were in the building on 9/11 and walked away emotionally devastated, scarred for life, and struggling to pick up the pieces to move forward. She's an author, a motivational speaker. She spent the last 10 years encouraging others they can still move on, move forward, and she recently completed her book titled 9/11, A Long Road Towards Recovery. Nicole, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me. It's a pleasure.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I can't imagine what it was like. And the reason I say that is we come from a place of we were supposed to have security. If anything was going to happen in the world, it could not have happened here, but it did. So let me take you back there for the moment when the planes hit. What went through your mind?
Well, Mike, in the very beginning, we didn't know what had transpired because Tower 1 was hit and I was in Tower 2. I didn't see the plane coming into the building, but we did feel the vibration and the impact. Our lights began to flicker off and on, and then all of a sudden it stopped. So we didn't think anything of it until I walked over to the window. And when I walked over to the window, what I was able to see was burnt paper, and it looked like a Yankee Day ticker tape parade. And it was in that moment that I thought, we really need to get out of this building. And so I began to walk with my assistants, and I encouraged them to let's walk down the stairs. And so we left the 73rd floor and began to walk down the stairs, but they were making announcements in Tower 2 saying that Tower 2 was secure, Tower 2 was secure, and that we didn't have to evacuate the building. So that brought another sense of peace and encouragement. At that time, we had heard that a plane had hit Tower 1, but we thought it was like a small CNN plane or MSNBC plane, and we thought it was an accident, of course.
Sure.
So we were on our way back up to the 73rd floor. I had gotten to the 44th floor, and the 44th floor was the common walkway. That's where you can either go upstairs or go all the way downstairs, and we were opting to go upstairs. Mike, I actually got on the elevator. And a divine intervention encouraged me to get off that elevator. And I got off the elevator. My assistants got off with me. We allowed the doors to close. The elevator started to go up, and not even 30 seconds later, Tower 2 was hit. That's the building that we were in. We were still on the 44th floor. And then the elevators that we were going to get on, they came crashing down to the 44th floor, and fire and debris and brick began to open and explode out of the elevators. But the door that I was standing in front of, Mike, it didn't even open. And so I just realized that, you know, I'm here, you know, by the grace of God.
Sure.
It was at that point that I knew that we were under attack.
Yeah, and that particular moment, realizing that you were under attack in the middle of the United States, even though New York is on the edge, but right there, what possibly could have gone through your mind at that time? We're at war. There are people here. It must have been something that went beyond anything that you could have conceived when you got up that morning.
Yeah, absolutely correct. I mean, that morning was a beautiful morning. Immediately, fear. You sit back and you go, oh my goodness, what is going on? And so for me, that initial fear, I couldn't stay there. Sure. As soon as that fear came, I just had to eliminate that. And I, for myself, went into survival mode. We've got to get out of here. We've got to get out of here. And I felt responsible for my team because I was the boss. They were my assistants, and the receptionist was with me. And I said, I've got to get us out of here. And so you're looking at other people scarred and injured right where you're standing, and you're like, if you have any chance of getting out of here, you can't break down now. That was what immediately went through my mind, my heart. And that's exactly what I did. I began to, you know, look for the exit point, and we found the stairway that wasn't heavily occupied, and we tried to get out of the building, which we were successful in doing that. You know, you saw periodically police officers and firefighters going in the opposite direction. As we were trying to go down, they were going up. Every so often, someone injured was being carried out, you know, ahead of us, and we all were making room for them. But you really didn't see the true devastation until you got to the mezzanine. I mean, forget what I saw on the 44th floor. When you got to the mezzanine, you saw a fallen brick and debris. But then you also saw individuals that probably thought that the better option that they had was to try to jump off of the building as opposed to coming out of the building. And those imageries will be with us for the rest of our lives. But
that's
we did manage to get out.
Yeah, Nicole, this is why I feel very strongly when it comes down to who makes the decision about, you know, waterboarding and the rest of it to get information that will save lives. There should be a team of people who survived 9/11. It shouldn't be people sitting from the outside saying that we're above that and so on and so forth. You need people who have been there, who've been through that trauma, that saw people die, that almost died themselves, to be able to stand up and say, this is what we need to do. We have an enemy out there, a declared enemy that cost us thousands of lives on 9/11. And look at the scars that it left on the people like yourself who survived. And this, the gentleness doesn't have to happen here. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, if they would have been afraid of us, if they would have known we would have done the same thing we did with bin Laden, they may not have done what they did because they're not that brave.
Well, you know, Michael, it is definitely an interesting perspective. I've always been an individual of faith, so I don't know if I would have wanted that option personally. But I do recognize that the emotional devastation that we've endured is real. And what I would love to see is individuals not make it so much political rhetoric as to whom and how we provide information. America's priority is keeping us safe. And I think that if we can focus on maintaining our safety, that would be the greatest advantage of being an American. It's unfortunate that we're no longer going to have that cocoon. We're not going to be able to live in that bubble any longer because people don't like us. And it's unfortunate that that's the way that it is. But I unfortunately think that this is a new reality for us.
No question about it. And I think when it really comes down to it, if you're an American, there, and I'm going to give you a should be. I don't know. In the last couple, 3 years, the divide here has been something like I've never seen in my entire life. And I've been around this planet for a lot of years now because I've always felt that we're the most powerful, physically the most powerful force on the earth. You don't stand toe to toe with us. We will take care of things. And if you want to get to us, what you do is you divide us. You allow us to implode from the inside, and you get everybody arguing back and forth and nothing done, and then you slip in and you get us, which is basically what's happening. See, my feeling about this is America should be a family. You know, we've got the culture that we were born with, the values that we're born with, and they're getting splintered and they're getting taken away from us right now, and we're losing that sense of identity. That, I think, is the major problem that we have. We are losing the identity that we should have to allow me to be your brother, you be my sister, we be a family, and we conquer anything that tries to stop that.
Michael, you're absolutely right, and if people really understood it from an emotional perspective, the objective of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda was to do exactly that. They wanted to break us from the inside. They attacked what we call the financial mecca of the world, and they've allowed us to come to our knees. And in our being financially drained in this last decade, as America has been, we have turned against one another. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, if you can remember, there was such a sense of unity, such a sense of support, and we have shied away from that. But I'm forever the optimist in the fact that with the death of Osama bin Laden, I see a sense of unity coming back together again. Or maybe that's just my, you know, my desire to make that happen. But I think we have a great opportunity as Americans to really come back together again and be concerned about our sisters and our brothers and be unified and not allow some terrorists or extreme terrorists to come and interfere with our lifestyle and our standard of living and our values ever again.
And it has to do with political rhetoric, political agendas.
Right.
We got to a point where the people that we've elected in the into office, they forgot why they're there. And I don't care if it's a Republican, a Democrat, or a Tea Party. It's all the same thing. We need a very fresh start because there's like this euphoria that happens when somebody gets elected into office. They forget what their main goal was in the first place. They lose focus, and then they forget about you and I. And that's why we got attacked, and this is why we're having the problems that we're having today.
And I have to tell you, that's one of the reasons why I took the time to write 9/11/2001, because I wanted the face of the survivor not to be forgotten. You know, at some point, it has shied away from this being a very real experience that individuals had to endure, and that we have real emotions. And I wanted to put a face to the individuals that had suffered. And I do believe that there has been a face, Michael, but there are three, you know, I've categorized this into three different areas. You have those that lost their lives on 9/11, and so their families need to be supported. They want to preserve their memories, and they don't ever want it to be forgotten, and I understand that. Then you have our brave firefighters and police officers and volunteers, the first responders, that came down, risked their lives for us, and, you know, helped us to evacuate the building. But then you have this core group of individuals, and I think it represents the majority of us, that were just like me, went to work on that day. Maybe no one thinks I'm a hero except my mom or my family. They may think that, you know, I'm a hero of sorts, but I just went to work to provide for and protect my family. And I was in what I consider a wartime event without any preparation. Those of us that have gone through and endured that, we've been forgotten. We've been lost in the shuffle. And I really wanted to put a face thing in. Listen, while you're talking about the politics of it all, there are people here that have suffered for the last 10 years trying to regain their sanity. Please don't forget about us.
No, absolutely not. And I think realistically, the people that are trying to regain their sanity, we've lost focus and forgot. You're the very people, because I say you, that's us too, but you happen to have been there, that the laws are supposed to protect, that the Constitution is supposed to protect, that all of the military might that we have is supposed to protect, and our politicians are supposed to protect. What's gone on is we've taken a second seat, a back row seat to everything else that will cause somebody to vote for somebody. And that in and of itself is the problem, and that's why you have lost face. People have forgotten because you've been buried. You have not been a benefit to a politician that will allow them to get some kind of a vote. As horrible as that sounds, that's what you're dealing with, Nicole.
You're absolutely right. And Michael, I realized that in 2007. 2007 was my absolute worst year out of this last decade. And I felt as if I had lost everything. I was struggling. I didn't know who I was. And I felt like my old self, that person that had gone to work on September 10th, 2001, no longer existed. And I had to take a very hard look at myself and say, Nicole, if no one ever helped you, if no one ever gave you a lending hand, if anybody said that they didn't care about you, what are you going to do? I realized that I had lost the ability to dream. And so I began to, you know, I began to dream again. And that's what made me even, you know, go out and start encouraging individuals. We can make it. We can come back from a catastrophic and a traumatic event. We can dare to dream. And that later on turned into not only just a speech and a motivation for individuals, but it then transitioned into me being able to write a book and have an inspirational song behind it, because the message is very real. Not only did we suffer as a result of 9/11, but there are so many people that suffer from trauma every day. And I just wanted to be the person to say, we can do this. We can dare to dream, and we can push past this trauma that is in our life. It does not have to define us. And I'm very grateful that it didn't take me long to figure that out, that so much so that I began to dream again. People around me, they share their stories, they're dreaming again, and they're beginning to realize that life is what they make it, and we can bounce back from a tragedy. So if America can get that message, then that will be a blessing for all of us.
See, we've forgotten who we were, or better yet, who we are. And what you've just said is, somebody breaks up in a relationship, if somebody loses a job, if somebody's business goes down the tubes, that's their 9/11. And 9/11 should be a symbol for being able to get back up and move forward. You know, this country was built on the dream, quote unquote. The American dream is you can do anything you want to do if you have the will and the power to do it. There were times you couldn't get in because of a gender, of an ethnicity, of a religion, or something. We have laws that stop that now. There is not a door in this country that can't get open if you want the door open. So 9/11 is going to transition itself to become the mantra, the war cry, to get back up on your feet and move forward. And if it costs 2,000 to 3,000 lives to do it, then their legacy is they've started, they've continued on what we stopped being. And if you're going to lead that that march, go do it, and I'm behind you.
Thank you so much. And actually, I don't know if you recall, at the State of the Union address this year, our president said in the midst of that address, as he focused on education, he says, America does big things. America dares to dream. And so if that can become a national dialogue, that you're absolutely right. If it took 9/11 to get us to the place to realize that we're stronger than we give ourselves credit for, and that if we always look inwardly and we are unified as a country, then we can go and we can defeat anyone else, and we can be this, I hate to say it, but we can be the superior country, the land of opportunity for real. Yeah. Then we would have accomplished much without changing or interfering with our integrity. We shouldn't have to sacrifice one for the other. And 9/11 should have allowed us to all look back and reflect. We're 10 years into this tragedy. This 2011 represents 10 years in which America was lost. This is an opportunity for us to begin to move forward and begin to heal as a country. And that's what I'm looking to see happen. That was the whole reason for me writing 9/11/2001, A Long Road Toward Recovery, because that's exactly where we are. We are on the road to recovery, Michael.
But there's got to be something beyond the recovery. And when I say, Nicole, something beyond the recovery, there's got to be a reason to be able to get the dream, move through the dream. You get a tremendous amount of kids today, they drop out of high school. Why did they do that? Because there's no value in going to high school and finishing it and going on to get a degree or whatever the case may be. You've got to be able to have something to look forward to, and that's one of the things I think our kids today do not have. The high school dropout rate is tremendous across the country. It's 25-30%. It's never been higher. And in certain cities, it's even worse than that. Why? Because the value for dropping out is greater than the value for staying in. One of the things that the kids are losing today is something called identity. They want to belong to something. And the family has basically been torn apart. Schools have been torn apart. So those poor kids that jump out of high school and they join gangs, they do it for one reason and one reason only. They're accepted, they have an identity, and they have something to look forward to. All we have to do is incorporate that into the schools, into our daily living, and something to look forward to, and all of a sudden, the value of identity takes on a whole different look.
I agree wholeheartedly with you, Michael, but I would say this. That begins with our family. Our family needs to come back together again. We need to be more concerned about our sisters and our brothers and our neighbors and be, focused on the welfare of one another. And when parents will be focused on maintaining quality relationships with their children instead of allowing the streets to raise their children, if we can get back to the basic values of family, then we will see those things begin to change. Because when you support your children in their dreams, their hopes, their desires, if you can identify their gifts at an early age, you incentivize the children's desire to go to school. It works very successfully in the sports arena. When you want to play sports, you have to have a certain GPA. why can't we expand that beyond sports? That sure. If you want to, you know, be the superior one in math or science, that you have to maintain a GPA that's acceptable in all of your other classes, not just math or science, and incentivize it so that we're acknowledging someone's gift or their dream or their natural talent, and we're allowing them to develop it and nurture it. And that comes from parents. That doesn't come from the school system. That comes from parents. I mean, I don't know. We're a little older, Michael, so we didn't wait for the school system, or my mother didn't wait for the school system to teach me my ABCs and my 1-2-3s.
No, absolutely.
We learned that at home.
Of course. But the other side of that is this, that, and we're starting to run out of time, Nicole. I could talk to you all night about this, but the parents have lost the ability to deal with their kids. We've had government step in. And when I say we have government step in, you cannot, you even constructively, you can't tell your kid what to do anymore. You can't chastise the kid, because if you do, when you wake up the next morning, there's the kid and their attorney sitting at the dinner, the breakfast table. So there is a problem also. Parents have to demand taking back the family. And I'm all for that. Okay, we got to go. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, I'm Michael Everett, and can reach me at www.NicoleBSimpson.com. NicoleBSimpson.com. You can find me on Facebook and Twitter, my YouTube channel. Any information that individuals would like to have about me can be found right there.
Wonderful. Is the book out yet?
The book will be out at the beginning of June. It actually was prepared and was supposed to be released on this Friday, but then the death of Osama bin Laden came. And so as an author, I needed to put something in there to reflect my perspective, given that we are talking about a long road toward recovery. And so we had an opportunity to add a footnote to the book. And so we'll have a June release right now.
Good. And let Radio Susie know when it comes out, and we'll have you back on the show.
Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you. I appreciate just allowing me to share my story.
Oh, my pleasure. Good night.
Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I think of the warm Caribbean. I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there.
It's Matt Whitfield. He's back with his features editor, Yahoo Entertainment. And we're going to talk about some dancing. Hi, Radio Susie.
We sure are.
Hey, Matt, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, our pleasure.
Absolutely our pleasure. Well?
Well, I should have been dancing. That everybody would have loved me. Okay, who got knocked out? Who got left off?
Have you recovered?
Romeo got the boot this week, and I have to say it was a bit of a shocker. I think the judges were baffled, and, you know, he was one of the favorites, in my opinion, and he is not going to make the semifinals.
I said to Michael last night, I said, uh-oh, Matt is not going to be happy.
At the beginning of the season, I wasn't sure how good Romeo was actually going to be, but I thought that he was fantastic for the past 5 or 6 weeks, and I definitely wanted to see him in the semifinals. But at the end of the day, people did not pick up the phone to vote for him, and that's what caused him to go home. I mean, Ralph Macchio was also in danger this week, but clearly he has a bigger fan base that's watching Dancing with the Stars, and they saved him this week.
Absolutely. I mean, I really thought he'd be gone. And he did, too. You could see. I mean, it was unfortunate with the injury, but it was almost like a given. I mean, I was shocked as well. I was very shocked. It comes down
by no means is this as big of a scandal as it was last season when Bristol Palin advanced and Brandy went home. I mean, that was probably the biggest shocker in Dancing with the Stars history. But Romeo not making it to the semifinals is still quite a big deal, especially when people like Kirstie Alley and Ralph Macchio, as much as I love both of them, are not as good dancers as Romeo. I mean, Chelsea Kane and Heinz Ward are still in the mix, and they deserve to be there. There's no doubt about that. But I definitely thought Romeo was going to make it and that Kirstie or Ralph was going home this week.
No, what's interesting, I was listening. Am I coming through okay on this? Okay. I was watching, not watching, as I was working this morning, I had Michael's favorite TV show on, The View, as background. And they were talking about what happened last night.
I can't help it. I'm going to hurt you, Suze.
I could not help this. And unbelievable, they did not even mention Chelsea as being in the semifinals. What does that tell you about the fan base? I mean, totally snubbed. Her name wasn't even mentioned.
Well, here's the thing. Before Dancing with the Stars, nobody over the age of 20 knew who she was. I mean, she's a star, you know, she's a kiddie star. And Dancing with the Stars definitely has a ton of children that are viewers, but let's be honest. I mean, she was a no-name. She's done a great job making a name for herself with Dancing with the Stars, and I think it's going to definitely help her and her career going forward. But you know, she's still not on anybody's radar, but Susie, she could easily walk away with the title.
Well, I still think she should. And I never heard of her before. I'm going totally by the talent. You know, I would say, and I'm not saying this is going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen. But I would put her as number one, and then Heinz. And then, we only can have three, all right? That's a tough one. The next one's a tough one. And Kirstie has really come a long way. She really, with that Argentine tango, really did a phenomenal job. And the moves,
I mean,
you know,
Kirstie has had some issues, obviously. She's had a wardrobe malfunction. There was the drop earlier in the season. But over the course of the past few weeks, she's really elevated her game, and she looks fantastic, and she's doing a great job, whereas Ralph Macchio started the season with a bang. And I really think in the past few weeks, he has just really started to go downhill. And I honestly thought that he was going to get bumped last night. But
yes,
he's still in the semifinals, and, you know, we don't know how many people are picking up the phone and voting for any of these contestants. That's data that we will never see. So who knows? Ralph Macchio might have the biggest fan base, and we just don't know it.
Well, you're right on that. And the fan base definitely is what carried him through. There's no question. I mean, at least with Kirstie, I feel, you know, the last couple of weeks she's really shined. And I mean,
she definitely has. And I mean, I still don't think that she is going to win the title because
I
think that the judges are going to give her the best scores over the course of the next few weeks. But her fan base out of the final four might be the strongest. So it really is balancing itself out there. But I don't think that people are also giving Heinz enough credit. You and I have, over the past few weeks, have said we don't think that he's the best dancer. You know, he definitely deserves to be in the semis. But,
yes,
you know, his personality is, you know, it's not the greatest. But people are not recognizing the fact that Pittsburgh Steelers fans, who normally don't watch Dancing with the Stars, are picking up the phone and voting for him. I think that is definitely helping carry him along throughout this season. And you never know. There might be enough Pittsburgh Steelers fans out there to take him to the title.
Well, you don't know. And it's not, you know, it's not like he hasn't done a good job. I'm even being very critical when I watch him. And he's moving very nicely. I think for me personally, he is missing some of the pizzazz. He is totally charming. and he can move, although Len has said he's got flat feet. But he definitely has a certain elegance about him. So, and he's likable. So he's not doing a horrible job, but I if he could walk away with the whole thing, and I guess I would be disappointed a little bit.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, and I am, again, I'm not the expert in the field that you are by any means. I'm just a reality TV show junkie, but I think that the guys have an easier time. The girls, I think, are always out there working their, you know, behinds off, and I really think that Hines' partner, Kim, is the one who has, you know, made their performances pop out on that dance floor.
I agree, and, you know, it's a tough thing because the pros are trying to make and should make their partner shine. That's what their goal is. But sometimes it's really hard to hold back, you know?
Exactly, I think that Anna has done a good job of helping Ralph look great out on that dance floor and really just, you know, helping him elevate his game. And I have to say this, I think Kim is kind of stealing part of Hines' spotlight, and I understand that's going to naturally happen. I mean, eyes go to these women in their dresses with all of the fringe. I mean, it makes sense, but I don't think that she is promoting him as well as Anna is promoting Ralph, and I think she's just definitely stealing part of his spotlight.
Yeah, it is a tough call. You know, and being on the other side, not being the pro, I'm going to put myself in there right now. We really count on them, on the other hand, to carry us through. It's a very strange, it's a very unique, I'll say unique relationship that you have with the pro dancer. And it's a really special bond. And so there's part of you that, as the amateur, really is going to count on them to pull you through. I don't know if that makes sense.
There's no doubt about that. And you can really see that in the relationship that Kirstie has with Max. I mean, they clearly have hit it off and they will be lifelong friends. I mean, that happens on many of these past seasons that, you know, they're working so hard together. They're out there in the spotlight in front of the world watching. And, you know, those bonds that are formed are lifelong. But Kirstie and Max, I think, just have the best chemistry, and I think that's also helping move them along in the competition. And, you know, the judges have been very, very tough, I think, this season, and I actually think that Carrie Anna Naba is possibly the toughest judge, and she's even admitting that Kirstie has elevated her game so much in the past few weeks. And, you know, I think that America is actually behind her, and I definitely still think that she has a shot because of that partnership with Max.
Well, that could well be. You know, I personally think Len is the toughest. Len is more, and I'm not going to put his age into it, okay? But he is more, Michael just woke up, but he is more traditional. And, I mean, I can almost characterize the judging. Carrie Ann is a little more technical, and Bruno is just like, let it fly. So I like Bruno.
I think we all like Bruno a lot because he goes off of the emotion so much. And are you out there delivering a performance that gets the audience excited?
Yes.
And, you know, I think that he's kind of the people's judge in that sense, whereas I think the other two are definitely more critical. But I don't know. I mean, at this point, any one of the four could take the title. And it's, you know, that's a good thing in the sense that, you know, halfway through the season, it was kind of, you know, this is a given, who's going to advance. But now that we're finally to that semifinal stage of the game, it really is exciting because it is anybody's game. And so that's why the next few weeks are going to be very exciting.
Well, I agree with you on that. I absolutely agree. I still say the top two, this is where I'm at. I'm predicting it's going to be between Chelsea and Hines.
I agree with you from the standpoint that they've both been the most successful and concise dancers throughout the season. However, I just want to flip that and say Kirstie and Ralph are bigger pop culture stars. And I think because of that, one of the two of them could easily factor into the finals.
Yeah, it sure is going to be interesting. That's for sure.
It is. Very. And I also have to say, this week there was some great performances as well. I'm glad that they brought back Michael Bolton. I thought he did a great job, and obviously Adele, who has the number one record in the country. I just think that this week we got some great episodes.
Yeah, I agree, and I'm looking forward to. I can't believe there's only two more times.
I know, it's pretty crazy. The season has gone fast, and you know, as soon as we wrap this up, it'll be exciting to see who the next cast will include. It's always, you know, one of those exciting nights where you're sitting around the TV and they announce it usually during The Bachelor or The Bachelorette. And, you know, it's just the show is still huge, and it's always interesting to see who they can pull out of the woodwork, who's going to be that next, you know, 80s star, who's going to be that next sports figure to, you know, take their career to a whole new level based on a reality dancing show. It's crazy.
It is crazy. In fact, they're working on the new cast, not the cast, the new celebrities. And so Regis Philbin supposedly said he was contacted to be on the show. And so they thought that was, I think that would be pretty great. I was surprised.
No, Regis, people love Regis. I think it would be very interesting. Obviously, he's going to be hanging up his hat and not going to be starring on his morning talk show. You know, he's going to be out of there pretty soon, so it'll be interesting
like November. He said, well, how can I do it? I'm here till November, and the next season would start in September. So
exactly, so it would be a fun way for Reach to go out.
It sure would be. It definitely would be. So, you know, I think they said the last 2 weeks that Dancing with the Stars had the largest, the biggest viewership. So
it definitely did. I mean, this show is battling every single week with American Idol to be the top show in the country, and it's kind of surprising again. You know, 10 years ago, everybody said, oh, this reality thing is just it's just a phase and it's going to burn out. Our top two shows, Dancing with the Stars and American Idol, both are having resurgences. Idol is definitely having a resurgence this season, and Dancing with the Stars everybody thought was going to flop, but it has still maintained that momentum, and it's kind of like nobody really cares who these celebrities are. They're just excited. I mean, this show is not going anywhere anytime soon, and, you know, the next few weeks are going to be very fun. We have a lot of finales coming up, and Dancing should be one of the better finales.
By the way, I hope Derek is back next season. I think he was doing
Derek will probably be back. I don't know that Julianne is going to be back next season, plus, you know, now the fact that she's dating Ryan Seacrest, she never, you know, if she gets a ring on her finger, she'll never have to work again for the rest of her life. But there always is something missing when that sibling duo is not on Dancing with the Stars, and the fans would kill to have both of them back next fall.
I would. They are phenomenal. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, on that note, Matt Whitfield, where can we find you?
You can find me across all of Yahoo's entertainment sites and on Twitter at Life on the M List.
Got it. And, hey, we're back next week, same time, and almost the last time for this season. I'll clarify
that. The countdown has begun, but thanks again for having me, and we'll chat soon.
Our pleasure.
Miss Molly, was I even there too? Well, a splish splash, forgot about the bath. I went and put my dancing shoes on. I was a splishing and a splashing. I was a rolling and a strolling. Yeah, I was a moving and a feeling. Woo! I was a moving and a feeling. We was a rolling and a strolling, moving and a grooving.
Lazy river in the noonday sun, linger a while in the shade of the tree, throw away your troubles, dream a dream of me. You know, before your sister was born, this is what your mama did for a living. Music opened a whole new world to me. No matter how bad I feel, no matter how sad or sick I am, I just touch these keys and poof, like magic, I always seem to feel better. I've always known you had talent, Bobby. This piano is for you. Charlie worked hard for it. See, Bobby? Why wouldn't have made you suffer so much if you weren't going to make up for it later? How happy you can be.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small.
Ruth Gareth was it, and she's the author of From Hired to Happy, The Secrets to a Vibrant Career and a Fulfilling Life, an executive coach, consultant, and a highly engaging speaker, and she's a trainer. She's got 30 years experience managing numerous organizations and Fortune tends to entrepreneurial ventures, and it's all about is your college grad ready for the world of work? And let us say, hi, Ruth, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. The book, From Hired to Happy, most people think they're going to get a job. They really don't know there's a strategy behind it, and they get disappointed and disappointed and disappointed, and their life kind of goes that way. Would it be interesting if right from the get-go, you had the strategy, you got the job, and you knew that what you set out to get, you can have, and it worked in all the different areas of your life?
That would be wonderful, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. But isn't that a starting point?
I think it is. And I think in today's world, for young people, it absolutely is the starting point. I think that's what they want.
No, okay. And when they go in, they don't realize that they should be also doing an interview too, because we don't know if that's the company we really want to be in. And they walk in, quote unquote, blind. They don't know what to ask. They don't know really what to do. And I really believe that getting a job, going through that process, is a learned strategy. If you know what to expect before you get there, the confidence starts to build. And I found, Ruth, over the years, that what we're afraid of is one thing and one thing only. We're afraid of the unknown.
Absolutely. In terms of the job situation too, there are so many unknowns for young people, and one of the issues is that, you know, one can pay a fortune for a great education, but there's no training on how to approach not only the interview, but what to do when you actually get the job.
Oh, you know, that's an interesting point. You're going through everything you can for the interview. It's like the movie, what was it, the candidate with Robert Redford. He goes through the entire thing. They figure he's not going to become president of the United States. They're just running him to run somebody. He ends up to be the president of the United States. And at the very end of the movie, he's driving with all of his people, and he's laughing, and they're saying, what are you laughing at? He's, now what do I do?
Well, exactly. And I think that that's what happens to a lot of young people, that eventually do get a job. And, in the old days, I think corporations, there was a different value proposition between the corporation and the employee. So, you know, I started my career with IBM, enormous amount of training, off-site. You know, we were actually graded. We were taught everything from the technology to dress for success to how to present and work with our clients, because we were going to stay there for the rest of our lives. That was the investment they were making in us. Happened, and a lot of other people have not, myself included. But I've taken that training with me. Young people don't get trained that way in companies today.
And the other side of that, I think, with young people today, the attitudes, the culture that they're brought up with, they don't coincide with what the wants and the desires of businesses today have. There, you know, it's different. You know, years ago when I was a kid, you went to work, you worked 8 hours, you got in at 9, you left at 5, yada, yada. Today, they can go out to the beach and get a tan and do everything you could possibly do behind a desk. They've got the technology behind them, and it's a different kind of hiree that we have than we had 10, 15, 20 years ago. So not only is it an education for the youngster going in, it's also an education for those people hiring those kids, because if they don't speak their language, Ruth, they're going to be in trouble.
It's always a two-way street, isn't it, Michael?
Yeah, it really is. And we don't
and
really
I think
look...
Go ahead. Oh, go ahead.
No, that was it. Go ahead.
What I would say is that technology has changed things, and also... you know, in the 1990s, corporations did a huge amount of downsizing, and that was to increase operational efficiency, which is a really great thing to do for companies. However, what happened with that was many people who thought they had lifetime positions suddenly realized they didn't. So it's not just young people doing things differently today, sure, technologically. It's also corporations, you know, aren't planning to keep people around forever anyway, in any case. So change is the norm in business today. When companies need to increase the bottom line and they can't make money through revenue generation, they will cut cost, and that means jobs. And that's just sure, the way of the world today. So everyone who's working has to have the ability to be flexible and respond to change in a positive way.
But that's something that you have to be taught.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's not.
Most people do have to be taught that, yes.
It's not natural, you know, and there's so many authors that I've talked to, and where your book should be, in the same place I've said to a few people, it should be in the high schools. It should be in the schools where they get to learn what it's going to be like once they get out, because you can prepare them academically, but they have, even through college, universities, by the time they get out, they have no concept of what the real world is like and what to do. It's a completely different world out there, and the academics behind them usually are not the propelling force that gets them to where they should be and they want to be.
Right, because the skills that really create success once you get past, you know, knowledge and competence are really the interpersonal skills. Having a strong, positive attitude, great teamwork, great communication skills, all of these things are the things that will carry you forward. So they do; they should be taught all the way through all of the years of education. Unfortunately, there's often a focus on just the more heavy academics. Now, I would like to say, too, in terms of the book, as you've mentioned it, so thank you for mentioning it, is really about the concept that we aren't two people, one person at work and one person at home. So the skills that it takes to be successful and have resilience, which is required to be successful, are the same skills at work as they are in your personal life.
Well, let me ask you this. Was this the lesson, sure, for you that you had to learn before you really were able to fully create this book? Because, you know, with an author, it doesn't matter if it's fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, you find that what it is, that core message behind whatever the book is a life lesson that they've learned.
Absolutely. As I had a lot of lessons to learn.
So, don't we all?
Yeah. And this certainly was one of them. And I would say on two parts. One, I've consulted to a lot of companies over the years, as well as worked for a couple of the biggest ones out there. I see people making the same mistakes over and over again. I made those same mistakes. So I really wanted to write a book that would help people not only get off to a strong start in their careers, but for those who've been working for a while and maybe disillusioned and just kind of showing up day after day, to find a way to re-energize, reinvigorate, re-engage in their jobs. So, and, you know, frankly, depression runs in my family, and that was one of the things I had to battle with. And I talk about in the book how to increase your levels of happiness in a natural way.
Now, by the way, happiness is an interesting word, like love is an interesting word, and relationship is an interesting word. And most people have no concept of what happy is or what love is or what relationship is. So this thing called happiness, this elusive thing, let's see if we can tie a definition to it and an emotion behind it. So how do we find this thing? What is this thing?
What is happiness?
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the questions I had when I was writing the book. So I took a course in the Fundamentals of Positive Psychology from the University of Pennsylvania, and I loved it because it was all about what happiness is and what it isn't. It is a very popular term today, so let's define it. I chose to look at it from a psychology perspective because I wanted to understand the research and the underpinnings in terms of research. So happiness is based on three levels. There's a hedonic level, the kind of happiness that you get when you get a new car and you can't wait to go to work because it smells so good to get in the car.
Yeah.
That's called a hedonic bump. Next is engagement. That's a very powerful place of happiness and very important to understand from a career perspective. It's where you are doing something that you are good at and you like doing. Those two things coming together. And that's when time passes very quickly, and the term is called flow. You're in flow. And then the third level of happiness that people write a lot about today is meaning. And that's when you're doing something that really is, you're involved in something that's greater than yourself. And I think that's a great thing to write about and to learn about. The practical reality that I was really interested in is how can we get into this engagement level far more often than most of us do by really understanding what we're good at and what we like doing and trying to create that from wherever we are in our work and in our lives.
And also to be open. And when I say open, let's say that you have a job offering and I'm going to apply for that job. So I come in and I give you everything that I can give you and you like me and you think, okay, you know, he's fine, but this is not the job for him. But I happen to have a department opening in this other department where he would really fit well. And when I mean open, there are things that people see that you don't see that you could excel at and really be wonderful in that you haven't even thought of. So it's called be open when you get in there. You may not get the job you were looking for, but something better, another opportunity can come along.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, this is, in some ways, this is just very practical advice, right, which is to make the best of every situation that you find yourself in. In my book, there's a story that I particularly like about a young woman who worked for one of the largest technology companies on the planet. And she had learned something about herself. She had learned that she really could do the detailed stuff. She was good at it, but she didn't like doing it. In fact, she became kind of obsessed over it when she was doing it. So she had the opportunity to move into a different group, and when she did that, she looked for someone who really liked the detail work and partnered with her so that this other individual did the detail work, and she was able to do the strategy work, which she loved. And so they were both happy. They were both able to use their skills doing something that they really liked doing, and it was very productive for the company. So I also suggest to people to look around and see who you're working with and who you could partner and share your workload with. And in today's work environment, there's a lot of teamwork opportunities.
So collaboration is very important, not only social networking, which is a good way to find a job, but when you get there on a 1-to-2, let's call it, that if you can collaborate with someone, you got something to share, you've got something that that you both identify with.
Absolutely. And that really allows you to bring out the best of what you can bring to the company. And, it, you know, you mentioned social networking, and I think that's a very important point. Again, another quick story that I just love. When I was I interviewed a number of executives and various business people for the book, and someone from, again, another huge technology company that manages a very large organization said what he always tells his young people is to get out of your cubicle and go to lunch with people and meet them and get to know them, because you can't really have a good know, like, and trust relationship with someone, which is very important, just through email and on the phone. And I think that's also very important for young people because they're very comfortable with technology and using instant messaging and all that sort of But you've got to really get to know people, and that is a face-to-face experience.
That's a tough one. And for most of the youngsters today, with the Blackberries and the texting and the rest of it, we seem to have lost a bit of that human touch. Now, going for a job, when you need that human touch, if you're not used to it, it's going to get lost in the mess.
I think it's something that young people are going to have to practice. And another reason to practice it is because one of the top attributes in all the studies, and certainly in my research too, shows that communication skills is a number one attribute that hiring managers look for, and that is verbal as well as written. And when we talk about verbal, the other piece is listening. One of the greatest ways to establish relationship and rapport and have people like you is to listen carefully to them.
Yeah, so, and listening goes beyond, there's a step beyond listening, it's hearing them. Listening is
right.
Good, but it's hearing them that's important.
Right, right. And that gets into the training around active listening,
yeah.
Which is to say, when you're listening to someone, then playing back what you heard them say. Oh, that's really interesting. So what I heard you say was this. Did I get that right? That is a confirmation, and in the business world, that skill will keep you out of a lot of hot water, because if you heard it wrong, you're going to get it straightened out before you leave the room.
Well, you know, a very interesting point you make. There was a time in my life where I did a fair amount of consulting. And what I would do is I would walk into a business and get the CEO, CFO, COO, whoever was in charge to get the subordinate beneath that person. And I'd say, write down what their job is. And they would write down what their job is. And then I would go to that person and say, okay, write down what you think your job is and what so-and-so expects from you. And then that person would write it down and have them trickle down and, you know, until they got to the last person in the business. And inevitably, when you matched it up together, nothing was the same. Ruth, the CEO's job description of the person underneath that. And then it went on and on and on. And that's where communication is. And that's where a tremendous amount of businesses fail, because they've got a great idea, good concepts. They've got the will to do it, the energy to do it. But nobody knows what the other guy means.
Right. So right, Michael. I think that for the individual, the more that he or she can hone her own communication skills, even if they're in an organization where those communication skills aren't strong within the culture, each individual should be working on honing his or her own skills. Chances are they're not going to stay in that position forever, but every job is an opportunity to grow and learn and improve for whatever is going to come next. But again, I want to point out that certainly from my perspective, from hired to happy is really about going from just being in a job or being in life to really moving into this state of engagement. And we do that by practicing these skills that you and I are talking about, not only in the job, but outside of it. You know, communicating well with a friend, a family member, a significant other. Really listening, really using active listening skills. This is a very transformative experience for people.
Oh, absolutely. A couple of rules when it comes to communication. The first one is very basic but very powerful. Talking is not communication. Because you said it does not mean they heard it in the way that you meant it. And that's where a lot of problems come from. We're starting to run out of time now. Let me ask you this. Ruth, is there a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. FromHiredToHappy.com. And if you can't remember that, and you can remember my last name, GERATH.com, will get you to the same place.
Wonderful. And if anybody missed it and went too fast, it's going to be up on our website. So we'll get you going that way. And can we buy the book on the website?
You can. There's a link to Amazon and to Barnes & Noble.
Hey, Ruth, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It was a pleasure, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. Take care. Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone.
That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms here in front of you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And by the way, don't leave us alone. 530-413-4511 or 415-287-0074 to call in. And again, oh, she's back with us. Susan Marshall is here, President, Executive Advisor, LLC, the author of How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work, a creator of the Backbone Institute. Susan, hey, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Michael Ray.
Hi, Michael Ray.
Guess what the topic is for tonight.
What's the topic for tonight?
I think you're beautiful.
Oh, thank you, dear. You're very kind to say that.
And I do.
You know,
I do.
Thank you. It's a perfect start, as you know. And actually, before we start chatting between
you
the
are two so
ones,
cute.
I would love for your listeners to call in and chime in on this.
Okay.
Because what we're going to be talking about tonight is this whole notion of beauty. As you know, I'm working on my next book, of Beauty and Substance, A Backbone Guide for Women. And I've been talking with a lot of ladies about the notion of beauty. And what's really been interesting over the last couple of weeks, we know there was a royal wedding, yes?
Yes.
Kate Middleton married William.
Yes.
And so it just in the context of beauty, I've been asking people, do you think Kate Middleton, who's now the Duchess of Cambridge, do you think she's beautiful?
Oh, I do.
So, Michael Ray, do you think she's beautiful?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's a something
Why?
About, there's an essence inside of her that I like that comes out. There's an innocence in her also that I perceive that I can see inside of her on the outside, and I think she's absolutely gorgeous.
I agree with you, and for that very reason that you said. But you know what's been interesting to me? The responses that I've gotten have been very analytical. Oh, well, or it's either, oh, my God, she's gorgeous. Are you kidding? But you know what? If you had that much money, you could look like that, too.
Sure.
So we rationalize, right? She's not naturally beautiful. But then I got things like, well, nah, you know what? She's got pretty eyes, but she really looks kind of horsey.
Do you know who I think is ugly?
Who?
Lady Gaga.
Oh, goodness. Why?
No, I'm serious. I just, there's something inside of her I don't like. And she is not attractive at all to me. And I feel kind of an ugliness in there. There, in that woman and the word beauty for me do not match up.
And isn't that interesting? And her fans will say, man, are you out of your mind? She is drop dead gorgeous.
Good for them.
I happen to agree.
They're
with
the
you,
ones
by the way.
Who will pay to see her. I won't.
but you know, this whole notion of beauty really gets people fired up, and that's why I say if any of your listeners are calling and they want to chime in on this, I would really appreciate their perspective because it's so interesting. She's horsey. She's too tall. Speaking again of Kate Middleton, she's too tall. She looks too sporty. And then there are people who'd say, you know what, I couldn't stop looking at her because she looked so happy.
Yeah.
the essence that you were talking about. And so in thinking and working on all this, I thought, you know what? That's our culture, North American culture is, you know, we have certain things about beauty, which, of course, are all over the map. And I've been researching and looking for international standards of beauty, and there really aren't any international ones. Tom Brady's wife, Gisele, comes as close to anybody will point to and say that she represents a standard of international beauty. But what's been fascinating to me about all of this is that we're looking at it from a purely physical characteristic.
Now you're hitting it. Is she beautiful because she's got a great rear end? Is she beautiful because she's got wonderful legs and she wears short skirts or shorts? Spot on. Yeah.
Yes. And so the question that I'm you know, kind of wrestling with here, is beauty important? And every woman I talk to, first of all, looks at me like, did you say something that I can recognize, or was that Swahili, right? Is beauty important?
Let me give you an answer to that. Let me give you an answer to that. Let me hold you up, okay? Then let me give you, ask me if beauty is important.
Is beauty important to you, Michael?
If you want to make money.
Yes. Bing, 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 yes. And it's been proven over and over again that more attractive people get higher salaries. Yes. And yet, the devil wears Prada.
Oh, sure.
And destroys organizations. So we have this physical beauty that, and there have been books and studies written too about if you're too beautiful, it hurts you, because there's something about that makes people uncomfortable. So the whole notion of beauty is really kind of tricky, is it important in the business world? Attractiveness counts.
Sure.
And attractiveness means more money. However, if you are attractive and you land a decent job, pay good money, and you are an ugly human being, right? Your essence, whether you're unethical, whether you're competitive to the point of taking out anybody in your path, et cetera, now you're a liability. And so it's nuanced, I guess, is the best that I can say. But when we take beauty out of the context of purely physical characteristics, now we're talking about something that every human being has access to, and that's uniqueness. And when you think about what every person brings to work, they bring their particular set of gifts, whatever they are. And yet, in our society, we are so other-driven, we're so responsive to what other people want from us. We are so concerned about meeting some standard, and again, in the context of beauty, gosh, if I looked more like her, I could earn more money. If he looked more like that guy, he could get promoted more quickly. And so we decry on one hand the superficiality of that, and on another hand, women in particular are so often searching for something different than what they have. I want different color eyes. I want to be taller. I want to be shorter. I want to be curvier. I want to be skinnier. And what this does just to a nation, to a society, is really start eroding not only the essence of this humanity, but the confidence. And as you know, that's kind of bedrock of my work. If we are constantly seeking to match a standard of beauty that we don't judge ourselves to be, our confidence is eroded.
Now, by the way, when you really come down to it, some of these kids that are absolutely gorgeous that keep ending up in rehab and in jail, they're not beautiful anymore.
That's right.
Lindsay Lohan and a few of them,
yes,
the same thing.
Yes.
When you first see them in the movies, they're gorgeous. And
absolutely.
Then all of a sudden, they don't look that good.
There can only be so many actresses who look the same. There can only be so many performers who, you know, rock the world with their eccentricity, Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
After a while, it just doesn't matter anymore. And I had a really interesting conversation with a woman who represents a nonprofit agency in a very wealthy suburb of Dallas. And she told me in conversation they had 79 suicide calls to a hotline in the first quarter of 2011, and 93% of those 79 calls were from teenagers. That's a problem.
But we know why. They're never going to match up to everything you just talked about.
That's exactly
right. They live their life, and they live their life always wanting, quote unquote. And they don't realize that what they have is more than enough. And those are not just
words. And what they have, nobody else has.
Yeah.
This is the thing that just really kind of blows my mind as I'm talking and listening with people is, you, Michael Ray Dresser, are the only Michael Ray Dresser that will ever walk the face of this earth for however long we're blessed with your company. Never one before, there will never be one after. And so you, just in by virtue of that, are fantastic, in addition to all the work you do and the people you know. But that idea, never, ever, ever, ever was there one of you before. Never, ever, ever will there ever be one of you again. You, now, this moment, this work, this time. And when we can start, particularly with kids, when we can start helping them understand that, then they don't have to worry about whether their nose is straight or crooked, whether their hair is curly or straight, whether their skin is brown, white, pink, or purple, and start turning them into sort of explorers of themselves. Now, slippery slope, depending on how it's framed, right? We don't want to create a nation of narcissists. But the antidote to that is to, first of all, help people generally, and the younger the better in my estimation, after ask them what they're good at. What do you really do well? What do you really enjoy? How then can we help you develop that particular thing? Source of confidence, source of competence. Third question, most important in my mind, what contribution would you like to make? Now we're talking about looking at the gifts and the talents, characteristics, whatever, however we want to define that, developing those for a purpose, for a contribution, rather than developing them to see what we can acquire. So it's really flipping over the equation that we write in our society today. Attractive equals more money. Yes, it does. And I'm not belittling that, and I'm not saying you should make yourself ugly so, you know, to jeopardize anything. Nor am I saying invest as much money as you can to make yourself gorgeous so that you'll earn more money. It's not, that link is not that clear. But what I am saying is develop you and then find a contribution to make, because the world is, you know, full of problems. I don't know. Have you noticed that lately?
Just a hair, just a tad. Now, by the way, there's something else that as you're talking, I'm thinking here, that you do the teeth, you do the chin, you do the hair, you do all of this stuff to make yourself look as great as you can to people out there, because it's not what you think, it's what you think they're going to think about you.
Right.
And you do all of that, and you walk into a room, and that person that could absolutely love you may not look at you because you're hiding who you really are, and they missed it.
Yep. Yeah, and in addition to that, and I love the way you just put that together, because the other aspect of it, when you do your hair and you do your chin and you do your... Now, every time you present yourself to the world, you're scanning for feedback.
Sure. Now, by the way, do you know why I like shorter people than me? Do you know why I hang out with shorter people than I am?
No, why?
No, seriously, because you can't see the top of my head. I'm a little thin there. So it works.
That.
If you're shorter than I am,
yeah,
you can't.
Well, yeah, but you can't bend over and tie your shoes either.
Well, I never do. In public.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, there are ways to compensate. But no, I really believe that thin hair, non-thin hair, if you're going to like me, you're going to like me. And there's nothing I can do. Or if you don't like me, there's nothing to change that. And
that's
the more
right.
I do, you'll find something else not to like about me.
Well, that's right. So, you know, that's one of those acknowledge and move on kind of moments.
Yeah. No, absolutely. There are a tremendous amount of people out there who are not going to like me the way I am. And I agree to that. That's fine. But if I fight that, what I'm doing is I'm going against their perspective and how they feel and think. Who am I to do that? So I'm going to go to the people who do like the way I am. And when we do that, all of a sudden, life gets a little better.
It gets a lot better, and it gets a lot more productive.
Yeah.
Because people who like you for you, and it's a reciprocal deal, right? You tend to like them for who they are. Now we can put aside all of the energy that we might be investing in, are you okay, am I okay, are we okay? And that constant questioning, and you're always making a decision, right? And every time you make a decision, again, you're using energy. Now you've got a whole lot less energy to do what it is that you want to do. And this is really the heartbreak when you look at school systems and you look at organizations, you look at businesses, you look at any place human beings come together to work together. When the confidence level is substandard, because...
Why should I be confident if I'm taught that there's no such thing as competition anymore, if I'm taught that everybody is equal? We are not equal. Some are better at some things than other people. And when you go do sports, when you play football, you don't all run the same way. The better team wins. And the team that loses, then you try to be better to win the next time. You see, we're losing all of those things today.
Well, we are, and we are unfortunately really destroying that essence that makes people beautiful. We are destroying that in children. We are making everyone the same. You know, we have to talk about equality, and we have to talk about all this nonsense. When we are truly robbing children of the opportunity to become truly awesome because of what they have, because of who they are. Because we don't want Johnny to make Polly feel bad.
No,
we don't want Polly's mother to be upset because
Johnny. There's nothing wrong with competition.
No, it's healthy, important. You know
what?
Absolutely. And if you think about competition in the sense, what do we learn in competition? We develop our confidence through not only succeeding, not only we beat the other team, but we learn to deal with disappointment.
And if you get beat, what do you do? You get better.
You get better. Or you decide that this particular set of skills that you're using is really not your strong suit, and you go find something else.
Did I ever tell you about this new venture I'm getting into, this politically correct boxing?
No.
Oh yeah. I've got great money in it. It's different than anything that's out there right now. Politically correct boxing is one element that the rest of the boxing world does not have. No hitting.
Love it. Boy, and, you move fast though, don't you?
Yeah, and you don't have a cut man in your corner. What you have is a counselor. So if somebody uses a four-letter expletive out in the audience, you're not that upset. You've got somebody right there to work with you.
How absurd, isn't it? How patently absurd.
Absolutely.
And, oh my goodness, it's everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere. And so, but we think if we give everybody a gold star and we make everybody on the A team, and you know, everybody gets to do everything, all of their confidence just is going to be preserved. No.
Let's take a look at that. And we're starting to run out of time now, but let's look at this. I'm in junior high school, and I'm told that everybody's equal, so don't try to be better than everybody else. I'm in high school. The same thing happens to me. Now I get out into the job market, where is the confidence building? Where is my area of competitiveness for me to get that job against the other guy? There's where the problem is.
You're absolutely right. And then when you get the job, are you good enough? Are you doing it right? Are you, you know, did they hire you because you're pretty? I mean, this goes so deep and starts so early that by the time we get this generation of kids and the next generation of kids to work, and at the same time we're talking about being competitive and innovative and, you know, surviving and thriving in a global economy, good grief.
Hear it loud and clear. Website we can find you at?
www.executiveadvisorllc.com. the book is there, and soon we will have the some information on the new one coming out.
And your counseling programs, that's on the website also, so somebody
Confidence
can call it.
Clinics will start in August. That will also be up on the website soon.
Wonderful. Hey, see you next week.
Thanks, Michael Ray.
Good night.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Andy Brown with us is an inspirational author. He's a futurist and a creativity coach. He's been inspiring people to fulfill their potential for decades now. His new novel is The Best Show in Town. Live your dreams. Let nothing stand in the way. Andy Brown, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, if that could be sitting on every kid's desk in school now, from middle school on to high school, it's called The Best Show in Town. Live your dreams. Let nothing stand in your way. Go get it. And there's too many kids that have bought those messages that they can't, and that in and of itself is a shame. How do you get them beyond that?
Oh, gosh. You know, kids have this wonderful potential. And forgive me, I'm nervous. This is my very first radio ever.
That's okay. I'm nervous, too.
And I think it all starts with parents accepting a certain greater responsibility. I would say a parent's ultimate gift is to make children feel lovable and good, to pay attention to them and really listen, and to remember what they said. And even when you don't find them perfect, to accept them for who they are, because every child is different. And I think it's not about forcing them into a mold. It's about allowing them to discover who they are.
Okay, now, but let's do this. First interview, I love it. Know this, okay? Take a deep breath. You're absolutely loved, and your topic is great, and we're going to do this thing together. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Okay, done deal. Now, when you're dealing with kids today, how do you get that message across? You can't just tell a kid that you're wonderful, because for the most part, with the culture that we live around, they don't believe it. So how does the parent take that first step?
You know, I think parents are buying into this culture of fitting their child into all the different programs, all the different slots, in buying everything, you know, for them and scheduling them. And I think sometimes the basics of allowing a child to play, and I think that words in reading are so important. I really think that we need to encourage children to find whatever genre it is where they like to read. I also believe that fantasy plays a very significant part in raising children. It's kind of a sly nod to the unconscious that the reality contract is no longer in force. In that it softens the boundaries of reality. And I have so many things to say. You know, I prepared so many notes in response to my talking points.
Okay, let me take you through, because I think this is extremely important, because the subject matter that you have right here and now, it could make or break how a child grows and deals with the world around he or she. a very important thing, parental guilt. Let's talk about that, because it's called the let it go. We are never going to be somebody else's definition of perfect, and good enough is a wonderful gift.
You know, again, I mentioned already all of this, you know, scheduling and doing, you know, this and that with your child. And sometimes parents say, okay, you know, I'm going to have 1 hour of quality time with my child in an evening. And you know what? You cannot guarantee that you're going to give that child quality time in that 1 hour. I really believe that quantity trumps quality, because in the quantity there will be some quality. If we can, you know, talk in kind of very abstract terms, I think our greatest chance of immortality is imparting something of ourselves to our children, and that comes through exposure, through spending time. And so I really think that all of these standards have been set out there. You should do this and that. And that can be very thwarting to the actual good of parents being, you know, loving and being there for their children. And then, you know, actually, you know, back to the issue of words, I think everyone has had the experience where you say something that you wish you hadn't, and you can't take it back. In words, I happen to believe, are one of the most powerful things on earth. You know, I'm told that in the beginning, God, you know, created the world with words, and words have an energy of creation. And the voices that our children carry with them for their entire lives, you know, their parents, the things they've said, are you actually properly instructing your child? Will the voice that they carry and remember of you be the voice that you want? And I think so often parents don't think that way. I think that, you know, they get caught up in all of these things, and you know, of course, we are not always perfect. We lose our tempers and, you know, wish we could be better. But I think that it is very important to spend time with children, because, as I say, you can't guarantee quality in select amounts. And it's very important to use a language that you want to embody the spirit both of yourself and the things that you want to teach your children.
Two areas here, Andy. One is when we talk about the words that you're talking about, it's not necessarily what you say, it's what they hear that's critical, and most of us don't take the time to say, what did you hear, based on what I just said. Another thing, and I think this is critical, parents are not paying attention to their kids. And I think a great example of this, years and years ago, there was a movie, I think it was called Our Town. And the woman, the heroine, the main character, had passed away, and she was up in heaven. And the angels came to her, and they said, we're going to give you 1 day back on earth. And she chose her 8th birthday. And she opened her eyes, and there she was in her bedroom, dressed wonderfully for her 8th birthday. And she came halfway down the stairs, and her father was there, and she said, Daddy, look at me. Look at my dress. And her dad said, don't bother me right now. I'm too busy making money to afford this birthday party, whatever. And then she got downstairs, and she saw her mother, and she says, Mama, look at me. And her mother says, not now. I've got to make the cake. I've got to prepare for the kids coming over for the party. And she stood there for a moment with tears in her eyes, and she looked up at heaven, and she said to the angel, I want to come back. This is too hard down here. And that's what most kids run into. The parents are there, but the kids don't exist.
You know, in my book, I have a line that if you don't tell a child she's pretty or smart, it may never come true. Sure. And we're saying the same thing. You need to care enough. With enough caring, almost anything is possible. We're here such a short time. I'm now 60 years old, and you know, I remember when I was very little, and you know, here it is, all these years have passed, and you know, I'm not complaining. I feel very, very fortunate, and yet it's so brief. And I think a lot of people get so caught up with, you know, earning and buying things. I can assure you that most of those things at the end of your life just don't matter. You know, it is the human relationships. It is, you know, the good that you can say you've done. It is the memories that really matter in the end, and it's not necessarily a possession, a thing, or whatever that may be. This condition of life is so precious. I mean, everyone hears that. You can get bored or think that it's almost mythical because, you hear it so often. But people get swept up. And I think what you're saying also is that people don't truly see. It's not just a matter of not taking the time. There is a deeper meaning to life. And when you look at all the successful people, and you know that what they have in common is a belief in themselves, and that, of course, that the power of belief is fantastic. What you believe to be true is your reality. Perception is reality. And guess what? You can reprogram that. And it's a matter of keeping things consistent, keeping your thoughts, your words, your actions consistent. It's a matter of creating for yourself that which you want. And I think that people accept this current, the undertow of society. And though I think we're very fortunate to have all of the technology and the progress and such, I think a lot of people also have forsaken their humanity in large measure because yes. They think that all of the things that society tells you need to have, they must have by some measure. But if you didn't buy the fine car or you didn't take the great vacation, but instead you stayed home and you went to the park with your kids, you might actually have a richer life because so many of those other things bring worry. They're transitory, and the material things in life really don't give you any psychic pleasure. They can give you temporal or physical or immediate, but they don't give you lasting pleasure. The car breaks or whatever. But it's a funny thing, and you sound like a mature person, but as you grow older, and I find as I grow older, it's probably just my genetics and the nurture of my life, the way I was raised, but I'm becoming much more emotional. And you know what? I love it. I see a sentimental movie, and tears well up, and I go, this is great. These are the human emotions. Wouldn't it be a shame not to feel those things?
Just very quickly, Eleanor Roosevelt said it, and she said it very well. And what she said was, yesterday's history, tomorrow is a mystery, and today is a gift. That's why we call it the present. And if you blink your eyes, you were back in grammar school. By the way, I was 8 years old when you were born. And so I've been there, done that. But the key here is this. It's the humanity, exactly what you're talking about, that seems to be lacking with the high technology. And there is nothing that will replace falling down and scraping yourself and running home and crying and have your mom hold you and say, it's going to be okay. We're starting to miss that.
And just what you said may be one of the great memories of your life, much more so than you could buy a Ferrari. It's a funny thing. I've already told you about my belief in the power of words, and I kind of have a mantra. And that mantra is everything is fascinating, everything is possible. Well, you know what a mantra is? It's a word or a phrase capable of creating transformation. And so all my life, I have said everything is fascinating, everything is possible. And so I go outside all the time, and it's overcast or there's traffic or whatever, and I'm not so dumb that I go, oh, this is great. But I always say, oh, this is fascinating. Isn't it interesting? And I think that the issue is to be open to the universe. I guess just a lot of people, there are the demands of paying bills and being somewhere and all the responsibilities, we have. And then, of course, the media is so effective in persuading people that they should do, this or that. And so often it's for, you know, the betterment of a business or something specific that, you know, truly doesn't benefit you in any great measure. I happen to believe that big business has kind of engineered these, you know, very great changes in our society, because when you grew up and when I grew up, you know, middle-class America, you could live on one income, and there weren't these expectations that you had to have, you know, riches and such. But then with the, you know, evolution of media, where an average person or a person of, you know, little means can see into the house of a, you know, rich person, well, naturally, you know, the poor person goes, you know, I want to have those things too. And so, you know, big business being smart has, you know, made it so that we, of course, there are other forces, you know, the currency and world changes, but has made it so that, you know, people now want two incomes so that they can buy all of these disposable things. And I think that surrendering our soul or our psyches to this materialism just provides, you know, very little good ultimately in anyone's life. They think that it's important, and I guess I'm no longer surprised at the position of status in the world, how so many people find it so important to have people know that they have the things that other people want to have.
Sure.
You know, because you know, in truth, there's always someone who has more than you have. You know, so really, you know, what are you accomplishing? But, you know, the greatest good is to discover what you're capable of. And we're in a constant state of, you know, becoming, and change and growth is good. You know, I want to be different, you know, down the road from the way that I am now. I want to be better. And money is seldom a factor in improving people. You know, money tends to allow people to be more of what they are, and as I say, seldom it improves them. So, you know, I don't think the world's going to change. I don't, you know, I think these things are just human nature. And if you look back to ancient history and, you know, Roman culture, wherever, you can kind of intuit the same things were going on in their times. So it really is, the factors are different today. You know, the technology, the scene background is different, if you will. We kind of live in the theater of our minds, I like to say. You know, we create our own, you know, realities, and what we believe to be true is our reality. But I think that it is pretty much the human condition that you know, people are going to, many people are going to miss out on the essence, the goodness in life, because it's just, you know, the way that it is. I wish it weren't, but it might also be hell if everyone were, you know, sophisticated and, you know, kind of jostling for all the same things. And I don't for a moment think that you know, bright people necessarily have an advantage. You know, sometimes intellectuals are more likely to intellectualize their way out of doing things. You know, they say this is not important, or someone else can do that, or I'm bored, or whatever. But I'm very keen on the subject of genius, because I don't think genius is necessarily born full blown from the brow of God. I think that you can become a genius on a very different track, because I don't think it's all about intelligence. I think it's about persistence in application, and I think so often an intelligent person can, you know, argue, I don't want to do that, that's boring, I'd rather flit and, you know, do something else in it. But it's the plotter, the person who keeps, you know, chipping away at that stone, who reveals this magnificent or great accomplishment, and then they come to be known as a genius. But you know, they may just be average people. So I really think the essence of life is essentially trying. Doing is being. There's a phrase that I like, you know, doing.
Andy, let me hold you up there, because I could probably talk to you all night about this, but that we're starting to run out of time. And better being in the being universe than the doing universe. One of the things that we have forgotten is to be mindful. Let me ask you this. Is there where can we find you? Is there a website, Andy Brown, we can find you at?
Yes, www.thebestshowintownebook.com.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And if there's somebody that you would like to hear, a subject that you'd like to have addressed on the show, get a hold of Radio Susie. You can find her at www.dresserafterdark.com and let her know. And you never know what can happen. There's so many people who never thought they would be on the air. And guess what? They have been, and they've enjoyed every second of it. We'll be right back.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy.
Ron Barak is with us. He is the author of several prior legal publications and Order of the Coif Law Review editor. He's graduated from the University of Southern California Law School, practiced commercial law, mediation, and arbitration for some 40 years now. He resides in Pacific Palisades, California. He is the author of, listen to it very closely, A Season of Redemption. A Season of Redemption. And let's say, Ron, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael Ray, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much. I fell on a word, and it's a word that I've never heard before, and I have been around academic people for years and years and years. The is it COIF, C-O-I-F, the honors graduate from USC Law School?
It's COIF. You spelled it right. It is a Latin term. Most of the law schools in the country have a membership in Order of the COIF and award it to people who graduate in the top of their law school class.
Okay. You know, it's a very interesting, and I have introduced so many people over the years, but it's the first time that I've heard that. And I'll tell you what, I speak for a living, and once in a while, I will totally do a stumble. Okay. Let's talk book now. A Season for Redemption. What are we talking about when we talk about redemption? That word is such a very powerful word, Ron, that it has so many different meanings. Where was it when you created the title for this? Where did you really want to go with the book?
Well, in my mind, there was much in the book that reflected on people trying to change things, trying to get from where they were to someplace better from their perspective. There's a serial killer. He was looking for redemption. He was looking to get himself, if not the world, in a better place. There is ultimately a trial where both the accused and the political system in our country today are put on trial, and the jury deliberates in depth about both of those characters, if you will, our political system and the accused in that case. So redemption comes about on various levels in this story.
Now, by the way, just to say this, based on that concept, the timing for the book couldn't be any better. We look at justifiable homicide, good, bad, or indifferent. We look at Bin Laden, who was just killed. Is there redemption in that? There are people who believe that there's a tremendous amount of redemption. There are people who believe murder is murder any way you look at it, etc. So there is also a moral position here. And morality is a very interesting thing today, because you could talk about integrity. And if the integrity really means exhibiting outside what you feel inside, keeping them balanced and the same. But if you come from a place where if your daughter makes a face at somebody, it's okay to kill her, then you're using integrity if you do kill her. So you got a real interesting way to go here, because of all of the different definitions of what morality is, what redemption is, and what a roller coaster ride it must have been for you to write this.
Oh, it was incredible writing it. A new experience for me. I'm a debut novelist on my way with my second title right now, because I had such a great time doing the first one. I wrote the first one on a dare. I was with some friends, and one of my friends, and with friends like that, perhaps you don't need enemies, put me on the spot and said, if you think you can do a better job than the book we were discussing at the time, why don't you do it and quit talking? As a good lawyer, I pretended I didn't hear the challenge, but I came home and told my wife that there was a challenge. I had to do it. Nobody knew until I finished. It has been a great ride. The book is doing nicely. People I don't know, have never met, are sending me emails and telling me how much they enjoyed the book. So I'm into my second. It's been great. The thing that's really been intriguing to me is, while it was fun to write it, it's been scary how much of what I wrote about in pure fantasy has been happening in the real world.
Sure.
Purely jocular use of the justifiable homicide legal doctrine has actually been used in a murder trial a few months ago. Didn't succeed, thankfully, in my opinion, but it's going to be appealed. The very use of the doctrine that I made in the book is on appeal right now to the U.S. Supreme Court. And my killer, if you will, in the book, is remarkably similar to Jared Loughner and what he did to Gabby Giffords.
Now, let me ask you this question, because I think it's extremely important. The book symbolizes something. And if you got right down to the core of the book, obviously, when you talk, killers symbolize something. It's far beyond one person murdering another person. When you talk about justifiable homicide, it symbolizes something. One of the biggest problems we have in this country today is the divide between the rule of law and the rule of man. And I'm sure you've been up against this time and time and time again, getting away from the Constitution, et cetera. Everything symbolizes something. So if you broke the book down, the symbology of the book, what is it that I would walk away with? What is it that I'm going to see, feel, and experience within this book that affects me?
Well, from my point of view, without wanting to give away the story,
sure.
I mean, the story is, on one level, a great thriller mystery read. I'm a big fan of reading. I love reading, and I love that genre. And I think this book lays that out there at one level for pure entertainment. beyond that, what you're saying, Michael Ray, is absolutely the case. There is a great deal of morality and ethics discussed in the course of the story, particularly in the trial and in the jury deliberations, and it has a real place in the world. One of the things I did, again, just purely for fun, was I took a purely fictional organization in the book, NOPOLI, standing for No Politician, and we created, with the launch of the book, a real world, real-time blog site that is blogging every week on real-time political events that need rooting out. Real issues, real-time, but the bloggers are characters from the book. Another level of taking the fantasy in the book with its issues of morality and ethics and actually moving it into the real world. And those fictional bloggers on Nopoli.org, they're getting hundreds of emails a week now from people who send them emails and want to engage with them, and they respond.
By the way, there's no such thing as fantasy today. When you really come down to it, we talk about fact, fun, fantasy. It's all fact, but it's put in such a way that we can look outside of it. It doesn't have to affect us, quote unquote, and we can see things we normally wouldn't see in the way that it's done. But the reality of it, and it doesn't matter what the subject matter is, there's fact across the board. It just happens to be framed in different ways. And the different messages, if someone looks very closely, there's some very strong and powerful messages within the pages of a book that's been put together in such a way that it has a message there. And redemption in any way, shape, or form, to whatever degree, runs in everybody's life in some way. You make me mad at you, so I'm going to get redemption. I might trip you going down the hallway. But the point of contention is redemption is something that everybody resonates to.
That's exactly right. I like your style, and I like your way of looking at the book and the title.
Now, by the way, the title in and itself says a lot, but let me ask you this, and I've asked this question many, many times over the years. Again, fact, fun, or fantasy. There comes the time when the author is somewhere in the process of the book and there's that epiphany, that aha moment, when you realize there's something in the subject matter that's beyond what you thought of, what you realized before. Where was that for you in this?
Well, when I started writing the book, not having experience at doing that, I kind of knew where the book was going to start, and I knew how I wanted it to end. I had no idea what was going to happen in between. And in each part of the book, I would spend a few days outlining before I actually started writing that part. For me, somewhere in the course of the trial, facts and storylines developed that really flushed out for me along the lines of what you're saying and led me to feel that the book had more to offer than just the fiction that it is, that it has a great deal of application in our real political system today and everything that will be going on between now and the 2012 elections. So it was when I started to realize that there was more to this story than just a good read, just fantasy, but that it really had some lessons and would have some appeal for those who are taking a real interest in our country today, in our politics and where our country and our politics are going.
Politics today are very frightening. And when I say that, it doesn't matter whether you're left, right, indifferent, whatever the case may be, we've gotten off course. And a tremendous amount of the ideology and the agenda of politics today is driven for, quote unquote, the vote. And they seem to have forgotten about us. And because of that, it's created a weakness within the country. It's also created a weakness within the justice system, and it made it very scary out there. There are too many people that are hamstrung that are trying to do a good job that can't because somebody is, quote unquote, using free speech and not allowing them to. Polly.org, now that's a very for real organization, right?
It is absolutely for real. And if one looks at any of the subjects it's been addressing, it segues right out of the novel into the real world and is rooting out real political issues that need attention. As you said a second ago, I'm not on the left side of the aisle. I'm not on the right side of the aisle. I'm fairly apolitical. But what I do feel is that our political system and too many of the politicians that are in it today are in it for their own agendas and not for the constituencies that they serve. And for those who are actually well-intended in the political system, it's very difficult for them to make a difference. In Nopoli.org, we have really tried to bring this to the surface, to bring attention to it, but to do it at the same time with a great deal of humor.
Sure.
So the bloggers are characters from A Season for Redemption, but they are blogging real time about real issues.
Now, by the way, I have, over the years, I've been doing this for quite a while, and I've interviewed a tremendous amount of politicians, and I'll never forget interviewing people who want to get into office. You know, they're mad and they're going to change things. And I've watched these people with these true hearts that really want to make change, really want to do some things, and they get into politics, they get elected, and then I interview them during that first term, and they're okay, and then I interview them, you know, 8-9 years later, and there's the one thing that they did not learn when they went in was there's something called consensus. One person is not going to get in there and make all the difference in the world. And I've watched, there's this euphoria that goes on. It's almost like a drug. And there's a power, and you have to see it before you can explain it. And it changes them. And when it changes them, they're not who they were going in, and they're not statesmen anymore. They're politicians. And that in and of itself is dangerous.
You're absolutely right. And it's not just in the legislative branch in our country. Michael Ray, what you just described right now is a phenomena that occurs in our judicial system as well.
Absolutely.
Judges start out being so well-intended and so ideal, and over a half a dozen years or so, they just get beat down, and they become...
I hate to do this to
you. Antiseptic about what they're doing, yet sometimes they make terribly important decisions.
I've got to hold you up right now because we're out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. It's www.ronaldsbarrick.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Ron, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Again, the name of the book is A Season for Redemption. And thank you, and I've enjoyed every second of this.
Thank you, Michael Ray.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
As they say in this biz, that's all there is.
there isn't.
Hey, thanks for listening, and tell your friends about the show. That's the way we grow. That's what you call networking. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.